This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, an election that bodes ill for the Haitian people.
But first,
there is nothing in the economic universe that will automatically rescue us from runaway inequality. There is no pendulum, no invisible political force that naturally will swing back towards economic fairness. Either we wage a large-scale battle for economic, social, and environmental justice, or we will witness the continued deterioration of the world we inhabit.
The arc of capitalism does not bend toward justice. We must bend it, lest Leopold's runaway inequality puts the facts in our hands so we can grasp what is really going on in our economy and what we can do about it.
This book is an activist's guide to economic justice. Thank you for being with us. And what do we do? What are some of the suggestions that are in your book?
Well, there are two kinds of suggestions. The first is, I think, as progressives, we need to realize that almost every issue we're working on is connected through runaway inequality. The book is designed to provide an analysis that links up the various movement silos. Over the last 40 years, tens of thousands of really good people have built up their 501c3 organizations around given issues, and they've created a kind of silo that they can justify so they can keep getting funding and survive and do good work. But we're now at a point where runaway inequality is so severe that it links all our silos, and we have to kind of make our silos more porous, where we begin to link up with each other around a common agenda. So that's the first thing, is seeing that if you're working on criminal justice or you're working on housing or you're working on schools, it's all connected through runaway inequality. They're not separate issues. The second thing are just, you know, very specific proposals that we need to consider. We need to put together a unified agenda, kind of like the populists did 150 years ago. So, public banks. We have one in the country in North Dakota. We need 49 more state public banks. That's one way to challenge Wall Street. Obviously, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour is very important. Putting together a financial transaction tax, a financial speculation tax on Wall Street's transactions, would generate enough money to take care of another problem, which is indebted students. We could have free higher education easily with a financial transaction tax. Besides progressive income taxes, I think we need to think about a cap on the CEO worker wage ratio. Back in 1970, the ratio between the average worker and a top 100 CEO was 45 to 1. Pretty good, right? You make 45 times your average employee. Now it's 829 to 1. It's absolutely obscene. In Switzerland, they had a constitutional resolution that went to a vote where they were demanding 12 to 1. You know, they got a million votes for that, over a third of the votes. And it was neck and neck until the big corporate money came in at the end. But we need something like that, maybe not 12 to 1, something that begins to put a cap on the CEO Wall Street incomes. They're ridiculous. They're not producing value commensurate to it. That's a lie. So we have to bring it down. Those are some of the proposals and many others that we review. You know, nothing particularly, you know, shocking or unique. But if we don't put together a package of these things, this runaway inequality is going to continue. And the consequences are enormous. It's connected to the dramatic rise in the prison population, for one. Wisconsin now spends more money on prisons than it does on its fabled higher education system. And that's not an accident. We now have the most prisoners in the entire world. America's the world's number one police state, believe it or not. We have the highest percentage and the highest absolute number, more than China, more than Russia. It's unbelievable. And if you look at the chart of the rise of the prison population, it was very flat from 1920 until 1980. When runaway inequality took off, so did the prison population. And that's because we gave up on having a robust public sector. We had a new philosophy, which in the book we call the Better Business Climate Philosophy, which said that we should cut taxes on the rich, cut back regulations, cut back the social safety net so that people go out and work. This was supposed to create a huge profit and investment boom. All boats were supposed to rise. But what it really did, it unleashed Wall Street. It got rid of all the good regulations we had from the New Deal on. And when Wall Street got unleashed, it proceeded to literally strip mine corporation after corporation, sucking the wealth out of the heart of the economy. and then the rich became extremely rich. And when the rich become extremely rich, and when corporations become excessively large and banks become, you know, obscenely large, they hide their profits, they hide their money, they move their money overseas, and you get a crisis of the public sector. So we gave up on the war on poverty. Our war on poverty became prisons. That's what happened to the people at the bottom of the income ladder. Look at Eric Garner. What was he doing when he was killed on Staten Island? He was working, right? That was his job. Rather than the kinds of job, public jobs that we were creating in the 60s and 70s, he had to go out and find his own job under the new regime of the Better Business Climate model. He was selling loose cigarettes. It was criminalized. He got arrested and killed. And the prisons are filled with people, small entrepreneurs, that have been trying to earn a living on the margins of society because we gave up as a society creating decent jobs, which is what we were trying to do in the 60s and 70s. We were trying to put people to work at the bottom of the income ladder. We were trying to deal with inner city poverty. We gave up on that, and now we have this explosion in the prison population. If I could make one more point on that I think is really relevant. Let's talk about Ferguson. And the counties around St. Louis and many other places in the country faced a fiscal crisis because corporations either were leaving or not paying their, you know, got a lot of tax breaks and weren't paying their full share. We can show that corporate taxes have been going down steadily for the last 40 years. And the wealthy, of course, find millions of ways to hide their money. We can show that the richer you are, the less of a percentage of taxes you pay. The poorer you are, the higher percentage at the state and local level. After 2008 hit, Ferguson hit a financial crisis. They were having trouble in their budget making ends meet. So what did they decide to do? To raise money. They couldn't raise it from the rich. They decided to raise it for the poor through fines and fees and very, very intense enforcement of petty crimes, getting people in the court system so they'd have to pay the court fees, et cetera. This was a deliberate strategy. There's a Justice Department report that spells it out in detail. And you can see we have a chart that shows the rise of revenues from poor people after the Wall Street crisis of 2008. And this happened in county after county all over the metropolitan area of St. Louis and, of course, across the country. It should be no surprise that that would lead to confrontations between poor people, poor communities, largely people of color, and the police. And if we just attack that problem as a criminal justice problem and as a police problem, we'll never, ever solve it. Freddie Gray, Baltimore. Look at Baltimore. It's a deindustrialized catastrophe. If we don't talk about a real jobs program for places like Baltimore, the way Bernie Sanders is starting to do, if we don't talk about public jobs, when was the last time you heard a politician of either party say that the government should be the employer of last resort, especially for people who are poor in our inner cities? They're afraid to say that because they're still buying for the Better Business Climate model. That somehow the private sector is going to take care of this. If we only got better education, there'd be great jobs for everybody. We knew that wasn't true in the 60s. It's still not true. And prison has become the place where we warehouse people because we are absolutely too chicken to create the public jobs that we need. That's the story of runaway inequality. That's how it links directly into the criminal justice crisis that we face now.
I want to also interject the question of the war on unions into this, because all of these wars began around the same time, around 1970, 1980, when we had the beginnings of runaway inequality and the big financialization that you were talking about and the criminalization of large sections of the population. So what should our goal toward be with regard to the labor movement, and what should the labor movement's goal be?
Okay, well, the labor movement was a massive victim of financialization, because as they sucked the money out of the corporation, and that's explained that in easy-to-understand five-step process of how corporations were financialized, that absolutely screwed union labor. They were, like, absolutely boxed in. To deal with that now, we need basic union rights, union card check, things that would make it, you know, easier to organize. We have to stop this pitting of private sector labor against public sector labor. It's going on a state after state after state. What unscrupulous politicians are doing is they're telling non-union workers in the private sector, hey, look, you don't have these good benefits. Why are you paying taxes? Why should you pay taxes for public sector workers that still have them? I mean, that has to stop. Tightening the restrictions on corporations and giving unions more ability to organize would be a huge step forward. You know, the fight for 15 is also a huge step forward. If you can raise the minimum wage, it'll make it easier for unions to organize. And the other thing that has to happen somehow or another is we've got to get rid of a Citizens United Supreme Court case. See, that's the next thing that happens. When you get runaway inequality, you get so much money in the hands of a few that inevitably they're going to buy political favor to get even more money. And you get a revolving door. Again, you know, I'm an old guy, right? When I grew up, it was a virtue to want to work in the public sector, right? It was a good thing to serve the public good. Now it's kind of viewed as, if you're really smart, what are you doing in the public sector? You should go work to Wall Street. So there's a revolving door of, you know, congressional staffers going to Wall Street and coming back and working in government, going back to Wall Street, making a ton of money for doing favors to Wall Street. You know, Obama's head of the trade delegation comes from Citigroup, and before that, he was the Clinton guy that fought so hard to get rid of Glass-Steagall. That's incredible, from attacking Glass-Steagall to Citigroup, and then his name is Froman, and then getting a $4 million bonus when he left Citigroup, goes to work for Obama, and sets up the TPP. So that has to all change for labor to prosper again. But the biggest takeaway from all this is we need to build a mass movement based on a broad educational campaign. The American people have no idea how bad runaway inequality is. When we do these workshops, it's astounding what people say. You know, before this book even came out, we sold 22,000 copies to unions and community organizations who are mounting a grassroots, worker-to-worker, community-to-community education campaign around runaway inequality. That's what the populace did in the 1880s. They had 6,000 lecturers, they called them, educators that went around the country telling their story about how Wall Street was screwing them. We need about 30,000 to match our population. But if we even had a few thousand, it would make an enormous difference. The Communication Workers of America in the New York area sort of leading. They're doing the first pilots on this, training their own workers who are helping them to use this book as a template for reaching other workers and telling the story, and then building a common agenda that can link them with community groups and other unions to take on Wall Street.
Les, let me ask you this in 30 seconds. Are you happy with the way in which Bernie Sanders is framing the issues around inequality? And I must admit, I haven't heard one single solitary word about TANF, about the issue of welfare. So I'm not very happy. Are you?
Well, part of me is because he took one of my proposals that I made 5 years ago.
He stole
the financial transaction tax leading to free higher education. Look, Mimi, I think it's a start. You know, he's not going to build the movement by himself, but he opens the door. Mm-hmm. Look, we had Occupy Wall Street. And what did they do? In 6 months, they got on the agenda, the 1% and the 99%. They did a good job on that. But they're not there anymore. Then we had Elizabeth Warren, who's still doing a good job raising some issues. Bernie's taking it a step forward. Now it's going to be up to the rest of us to actually build a national organization. I'm a believer in organization. That spontaneous combustion is not going to work. I think Occupy Wall Street kind of proved that. We need real organization. We need to have groups that have members.
You know something, we're going to have to leave it there on real organization and tell people you need to get a copy of Runaway Inequality, which is designed to address the problems faced by everyday working people with charts and graphs, and it's digestible and it's readable, because we need a mass movement to address runaway inequality. And Les Leopold helps us do that. Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice by Les Leopold, put out by Labor Institute Press. And thank you for joining us, and thank you for the important work you do. We got to stop runaway inequality.
Thank you.
I was four years old when the Marine left Haiti, the U.S. Marine left Haiti. I was a kid. And every time a Marine battalion passed in front of the house, my father took my hand and said, "Don't look at them. Don't look at them." And every May 18, which is the flag day, defiantly, he put the Haitian flag in front of the house. And I said, "Father, what is that? What does that mean for you?" He said, "That means that you are Haitian." that mean that my great-grandfather fought at Berthier. Never forget that. You are Haitian. You are from this land. You are not French. You are not British. You are not American. You are Haitian.
Wyclef Jean, and we hope that brings us to the contemporary piece that we're going to be dealing with. Now we're joined by Kim Ives, who is the editor of Haiti Liberté, the largest Haitian weekly newspaper distributed throughout the United States, Canada, Europe, and Haiti. He joins us to talk about the political situation on the ground in Haiti and the upcoming elections as the campaign season for the final round of Haitian elections has gotten started, and the second place finisher in the presidential vote that he hasn't decided whether he will participate in a runoff or continue to press for a recount in an election that has already been shown to have been patently fraudulent. Kim, what is the situation on the ground now? How do we assess and understand these elections in any event?
Well, yes, Mimi, and just one correction. I'm just an editor at Haiti Liberté, not the editor. The
more than modest
situation is well, no, I'm just helping out there. But
Thank you. The
situation in Haiti is becoming worse by the minute. The second place finisher that you spoke of, Jude Celestin, of the Alternative League for Progress and Haitian Emancipation, La Paix, in fact, came out in a statement with a group of eight. That is, eight of the leading presidential candidates who came in after the ruling party's candidate, Jovenel Moïse, and said that they would not participate in any second round. He said he would not participate in any second round, and that they are calling for a complete overhaul of the Provisional Electoral Council, or KEP, and the Haitian National Police. And if that doesn't happen, they want President Michel Martelly to step down, what they are calling a transition in Haiti. And so the thousands of people, the masses of Haiti, were out in the street on November 29th, which was the 28th anniversary of a very bloody electoral massacre in 1987. When neo-devaluerist thugs took machetes and machine guns to would-be voters at polling places around Haiti. It's a real standoff. I mean, what we see in Haiti, where although there are thousands in the street, although almost all of the presidential candidates, there were 54, have denounced the vote results announced from the October 25th second round, nonetheless, we see the U.S. standing four square behind Martelly and this electoral coup d'etat, as the people of Haiti are calling it.
Well, Kim, without consulting the Haitian people, the imperialist countries really decided that there would be an election. And, of course, there are huge sums of money that have been freed up for this event while the victims of the earthquake are still housed under makeshift tents and tarps with little or no protection against the rains, not to mention hurricanes. So how are we to, in any event, understand the nature of these elections and clearly the construct of the foreign interventionists who really still control and occupy Haiti?
Well, that's just it. These are essentially, and you'll see that slogan often in Haitian demonstration, occupation elections. Haiti is the only country in the Western Hemisphere with a United Nations intervention occupation force. Let us recall that was in 2004 that former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was given a U.S.-backed coup d'etat on February 29th, 2004. And that was followed by an occupation of 3 months by U.S. Marines, French troops, and Canadian troops. And then they passed it off to the United Nations, a force which is called MINUSTAH. And even though it was supposed to be there for a couple of months, it has now been there for 11 years, and it was just renewed in October for another year. The Haitian people have said that there can be no free and fair elections with Minista, and in fact, the last elections that brought President Martelly to power were essentially intervened in by Minusta and the U.S. when the wrong results came about. And they intervened and kicked out the second place contender, who is, again, in this election, the second place contender, Jude Celestin, and they replaced him with Michel Martelly, who went on to win the election. So we see one illegal election now being followed by a second illegal election. And again, the U.S. is standing behind both these travesties and saying, well, it's Haiti, you know, it's not perfect, but there it is. We have to go forward. Unfortunately, the Asian people this time have, unfortunately for them, have had enough and are saying they're not going to swallow this election.
Tell us more about Juvenal Moïse, the candidate who is backed by the government at this time, and for that matter, Jude Celestin as well.
Yes, well, Juvenal Moïse is a banana grower and exporter who was basically handpicked and has been plucked out of obscurity. Nobody knew him in the past. He hasn't stood for anything. He just was dropped in there as Martelly's candidate in what is called the Bald-Headed Haitian Party, PHTK. Many had thought that it would have been Martelly's business partner and longtime prime minister who was run out of the country in December 2014, Laurent Lamothe, but in a way to sort of assuage people and lower their guard, they kept disqualified Lamothe, and so it was Jovenel Moïse who came in. But he apparently has benefited from a huge, some kind of fraud, because he got 500-odd thousand votes. Meanwhile, Jude Celestin, who is really some sort of a candidate of former President René Préval, came in second place with 25% of the vote to Jovenel Moïse's 33%. Jude Celestin himself is a Swiss-trained engineer who ran Préval's heavy equipment operation, which helped to build and rebuild a lot of the roads in Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. But I could say neither one is a truly popular leader. The two Lavalas currents, I could call them, that most people were betting on, or most of the Haitian people, I should say, is won by, headed by former Senator Moïse Jean-Charles, called the Petit Dessalines or Dessalines Children, and the other is headed by Dr. Maryse Narcisse, and that's the current which is backed by former President Aristide. But those two placed respectively third and fourth place. So everybody is crying foul and saying that's quite impossible that Moïse Jean-Charles and Dr. Maryse Narcisse would come in third and fourth place after the other two.
In the minute or two that we have left, which isn't enough time, but we will have you back more often, just in a minute or so, what is the prognosis or the position perhaps that we should take relevant to what is more and more activity on the ground from the Haitian people in resistance to and protest of what has already been shown to be an extraordinarily fraudulent process?
Well, I think here in the U.S., people have to say to the Obama administration that they have to stop meddling in Haiti's elections, in their internal affairs. The U.N. occupation has to be removed. President Martelly, it is clear the Haitian people want him out. It's a lot like Guatemala, Mimi, where we saw the Guatemalan people ran the president out of there, even though he was on the way out already. But as a matter of principle, they said, get him out. And that's really what the Haitian people are asking, too. They don't want Martelly there. They don't want the UN occupation there. They want to have an election. And, of course, an election is the most sovereign thing a people can do. I mean, that determines everything. And these are major elections, Mimi. They're not just for the president. It's also the entire legislature and all the mayors, all the local officials are also being elected in it. So it's a huge election for Haiti's future, and the Haitian people have the right to do it in full sovereignty.
And of course, as Gerald Horn said, we owe a huge debt to the Haitian people. Pay close attention to what is happening in Haiti. Kim Ives is an editor of Haiti Liberté, the largest Haitian weekly newspaper distributed throughout the United States. Going to join us much more frequently as the elections get closer. Thank you so much for spending some time with us, Kim.
Thanks a lot, Amy.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.